Welcome to Nothing Ventured, a podcast exploring the stories that make the incredible world of tech and venture tick. Join me, Arish Shah, as I speak to the founders, investors, and ecosystem operators trying to make a dent in the future. Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today, it is absolutely wonderful to have with me Nick Telson. Nick is a prolific founder, angel investor, and host of the Pitch Deck Pod, one of the top 10 global podcasts. Nick co-founded Design My Night at the time, one of the UK's fastest growing nightlife websites with over 6.5 million monthly views. After exiting Design My Night to the Access Group in December of 2017 and remaining with the business for the next couple of years, Nick moved his focus to angel investing through Horseplay Ventures, hosting the Pitch Deck podcast, where he has interviewed a host of founders pitching their ventures in 10 minutes to Nick and a multitude of angels and VC investors, and is getting back to his love of building by co-founding and incubating new ventures, the most recent being Trumpet, which allows salespeople to create personalized pitches effortlessly. Nick, it's great to have you on the podcast today. Thank you so much for joining me.
No, brilliant. Thanks for having me. I look forward to it.
Awesome. So let's dive straight in. That was a lot of intro. You've moved from kind of corporate environments like L'Oreal to founding and exiting Design My Night, onto angel investing and full circle back to founding again. What gets you out of bed in the morning? Is it all of the above, or is there one thing which you love above and beyond everything else?
I think just the excitement of building, which is why my co-founder Andrew and I of Design My Night went back into building companies again. It was sort of a big question we asked ourselves when we exited Design My Night. We fortunately exited very well and don't need to work, but when you're in your 30s and you don't need to work, it's almost counterintuitive, because then it makes you think, okay, well, I'm too young to be playing golf every day. I'm too young just to be going for coffees and lunches all day. What does get you out of bed in the morning? What is your purpose? So it was actually a bit of soul searching we did. And fortunately or unfortunately, it was during COVID. So we actually couldn't, go away and travel and all of that. I think we both luckily realized that we just love building businesses. That's why we came up with Trumpet and launched that recently. That really is what drives us from a day-to-day point of view.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that irrespective of who I talk to, there's not a single founder that I've met that said, yep, I'm done now. that's enough time to kind of, as you say, sit around, play golf, go traveling. That's it. You might do that for a few months or so, but I think life gets very boring. And I'm super intrigued actually to learn more about Trump. I'm sure we'll talk about that a bit later. But one of the things that I think that a lot of people assume is that money effectively allows you to stop doing stuff. But I think the reality is that money allows you to focus on the things that you want to focus on. And I think that's the privilege that, that certainly sounds like you have been able to take advantage of after the exit. I mean, you've actually talked a lot about Design My Night on LinkedIn and elsewhere. And what strikes me most about that journey, it's almost the antithesis of the sort of venture fuel, live or die by the sword kind of type of stories that we hear all the time on social media. The business was, barring a couple of angel rounds, bootstrapped. And you and your co-founder were very intentional about the outcomes you wanted to achieve. Can you talk us through how you made those decisions and how you kept yourself on track throughout the sort of 6 or 7 years from founding the company all the way through to exit?
Yeah. So we founded it in 2009, 2010. So the sort of angel VC world was very different back then. We weren't connected either as founders. So we almost didn't think that VC was even an option. It was actually our mentor who became one of our angel investors who told us about angel investing and, we should put some angel money in to help you grow it. So it was deliberate in as much as we didn't know the alternative. And I think bootstrapping allows you to really focus on the core mechanics of your business. And I'm not saying if you get VC backed, you can't do that. But because money's so tight, you know, everything you spend has to grow the business, and you can only spend when you are growing the business. So, you know, it makes you very head down as a founder, very focused, and really trying to find the levers of growth. And I think that focus allowed us to pivot the business. We started as a pure B2C brand, you know, competing with, say, Time Out. But then we, you know, quickly, well, in a couple of years, realized that that wasn't going to get us to sort of the dream exit that we wanted. And we had to look for other levers to pull, which for us was SaaS. So, you know, we then built a booking software and a ticketing software. And that, fortunately, was the thing that really drove our business on. The beauty of SaaS as well is when you get that right, you know, it's once you've got a good product that people want, it's actually just hiring salespeople, hiring customer success, and you just keep doing that. So as we got more customers, we would hire another salesperson. And with a salesperson, you say, okay, you know, they should be bringing in 150 grand ARR and they're costing us 60 grand. Great. If they're doing that, we get another one. And that cycle follows. So it allows you to be quite deliberate in the hiring choices you're making to grow the business. In terms of the exit strategy, again, we were very deliberate in that. We knew, you know, Design My Night wasn't going to be something we wanted to do forever, nor is it a business that's sort of changing the world for the better. So for us, it was more the thrill. We were mid-20s when we started it. So the thrill of starting your own business, the excitement, the autonomy of that, testing ourselves. But the other side of it was money-driven. Like, we were like, well, if we can enjoy this ride and be financially free by our early mid-30s, that's a big tick in the box. So, yeah, to cut a very long story short, we thought, you know, sort of 3-5 years out, and we looked at what SaaS valuations were getting in hospitality. It became quite an sort of acquirable space, luckily for us. This pre-COVID, obviously. And we just thought, okay, well, look, if to hit this exit money that we need to be doing this much EBIT or revenue. And let's work back from that. So we basically forecasted out pretty damn closely. I don't know how, you know, our forecasting was pretty bang on. Out 5 years, and then probably a year out from our fifth, we were like, okay, next year we might be hitting those revenue and EBIT targets. If there is someone that wants to buy us, those multiples will get us that dream exit that we both want. So we engaged the broker, and, you know, it took like 8 months to sell the business. And that's how we did it. So it's very methodical. Obviously, you don't know if someone's going to want to buy your business, but you never know that. So that was the only nervous part of selling the business, was we knew we'd get the valuation. It was a very healthy business, very profitable. But it was just whether someone had the drive to spend that money on us.
Amazing. I mean, there's a few things I want to talk about there. First of all, you know, forecasting being bang on, you're right to put me out of a job. So we'll skip over that one as quickly as possible. For our listeners, Nick obviously talked about ARR, EBIT, and a variety of kind of financial metrics there. So ARR obviously being annual recurring revenue, EBIT being earnings before interest and tax. One of the things I'd love to ask you, right, is, you know, you talked a lot about bootstrapping there, and a lot of the founders that I talk to struggle with the debate around whether to bootstrap or to take external funding, or certainly venture funding. It's a debate I'm having with myself on a daily basis at the moment, right? What do you think bootstrapping allowed you to do that would have been harder had you have taken venture or gone down the venture route?
It's interesting, yeah. But people ask me this a lot, and actually, for Trumpet, we have gone down the VC route, which we can talk about. So, you know, I'm doing both. So I'm not saying I'm a massive advocate of one over the other. It definitely depends on the business. What I think it allows you to do is definitely harder, because obviously you will naturally grow smaller, slower, because you can only reinvest from the money you make. So, you know, even if you've got product market fit, you can't go and hire 6 salespeople. A as I said before, you have to hire one. When they're bringing the revenue, you then hire the second one. So you will naturally grow slower, but what it allows you to do is just have that autonomy. You know, if you're bootstrapped, you've really got no one to answer to. You've got no pressures, external pressures on revenue growth, on hitting those numbers. So I think it just allows you to be a lot more focused. I feel that with a lot of founders that get VC money early on and might be first time founders, their eyes are sort of wide open, and you sort of lose the focus of product market fit. You lose the focus of your revenue levers. You lose the focus of trying to get profitability. So I think it forces you to be incredibly focused and focus on the things that are important, which essentially are revenue and profit. But it is a lot harder.
Yeah, I think, you know, you use the word focus earlier and again just now, and it's very clear that if you're bootstrapped, it sounds to me like you cannot afford to take multiple bets, as you often will when you take venture funding, because venture funding allows you to move faster, try things out, and if they don't work, you try something else, et cetera, because you have the capital, you have the balance sheet to be able to do that. Whereas obviously if you're bootstrapped, as you said, you can only reinvest the money that you make. And that's not revenue, that's actual, you know, net profit. That's profit after you've paid everyone else's salaries, et cetera, right? So one thing I'd be really interested to understand, and I think you've talked about this a little bit on LinkedIn as well, is what were the kind of core metrics that you guys were focused on? Was it just ARR? Was it just sort of the net profitability? What were you really focused on, not just for the exit, but just also to give you kind of the, you know, the that kind of North Star that you're heading in the right direction? You know, what was really important in Design My Night?
Yeah, the obvious ones for us were, so the website remained very important, right? So that was our flywheel. So what happened for us was our B2C arm, so designmynight.com, which, you know, a lot of people will know, but don't realize there's a SaaS business behind it, is we had venues that wanted to be on Design My Night as a promotional tool. But they couldn't be on Design My Night unless they used our software. So the bigger the website, the more impetus the venues we were trying to get onto our software wanted to be on our site. Once we signed them up, the site got bigger, more content, more SEO equals more traffic. More traffic meant more demand, and that's how our flywheel circled. So one big key metric from day one, especially when we were just B2C, is traffic. So we were, you know, religiously looking at our traffic, especially in the early days. But we had to keep seeing that traffic growth. SEO was very important to us. So the metrics of where the traffic was coming from, what pages do very well. We were obsessed with the exit pages, where people leaving our website. One part of our model was obviously booking revenue. So if you book through our site, we would take a commission from that as well. You know, and when you've got millions of people going to your site, that can be quite tasty, that commission. So the difference between, you know, 2-4% conversion rate is quite high. So those were the key metrics of the website, around the traffic. And then the SaaS side of it was your standard SaaS metrics, which should be MRR, ARR, churn, ARR and MRR, obviously equal number of customers as well. But you also want to make sure you've got a blend of customers. So you're not relying too heavily on one or two customers. So the spread of your MRR and ARR is important. We also looked at users. So not just the people that signed up, but then how many people within each restaurant, let's say, were using our software. That shows it's more ingrained in their operations as well. So the more tentacles you could get out into people's operations, the better. So yeah, those were the key ones. And obviously all of that drove our revenue, and all of that then drove our EBIT. So, you know, they were the numbers behind the two big ones that we used for exit.
Yeah, I think, you know, SaaS metrics especially are quite well known, but you know, the reality is that you can always go behind the headline stuff. So as you said, yes, you have, you know, subscribers, but how many users? The users tells you how sticky the product is, how ingrained it is, as you said, in your customer's business, which hopefully will kind of inform the longevity, i.e. the lifetime of that customer, right, as well, because the more users that are using it, the more regularly it's being used, the less likely they are to churn. So everything kind of impacts, you know, another metric. And in fact, I think today, you know, especially as we kind of head into the VC winter or whatever it's being called at the moment, you know, it's really important to think about retention over and above acquisition, right? So how do you keep customers? How do you maintain that stickiness over time? I think for anyone listening out there, it's really important to choose two or three that really make a difference to your business, that go beyond just the obvious sort of revenue numbers as well. Because I think what I tend to find is if you focus only on revenue, then you actually lose sight of where the value is being created, right? So you may be doing making decent revenue, but if you're losing the sort of customers that could, you know, could be upsold or could be cross-sold or whatever it might be, then that points to something problematic in the business as well. So let's talk about angel investing for a moment. Can you talk us through your approach, the sort of deals you like, and what is most important to you? Is it the team, the tech, the traction, or is it something else altogether?
So angel investing. So I'm in about 54, 55 startups now. Pretty varied. So I don't really have like a vertical that I will only invest in. I feel more comfortable in what I know. So SaaS. Obviously, the scalability of SaaS is attractive for investors as well. I also, before I invest, really like to dig on the numbers and dig on the business plan. And I can just understand that better when I'm looking at a SaaS business rather than, let's say, D2C, where, you know, I haven't had experience as an operator. So pretty varied. You know, having said that, I do have some D2C businesses. My verticals are incredibly wide ranging, from sort of impact investing to SaaS across lots of different verticals. You know, I've got even some like farming tech, ed tech, insure tech, fintech, so all across the spectrum, really. And I think that's important from a diversification point of view. And I do constantly look at my portfolio, and if I do have too many in one particular area, even if there is a good opportunity, I will probably say no just to diversify my portfolio. You never really know where the next tailwind's going to come. From a Web3 point of view, blockchain, I'm still sort of learning. I'm happy to miss out on maybe some super early opportunities that, you know, could be the next Facebook, let's say. And just want to see where that market settles. I think as an angel investor, you also just need to be very humble and realize that you don't know everything, far from it. So you need to learn the industries that you want to invest in as well. So that's all very new to me as a person as well. So yeah, I'm looking at lots of decks in that area, not at the moment maybe to invest, but just to understand what's going on and speaking to other angel investors in that space. I don't have FOMO of like, I want to be the early one in Web3. I'm happy to let that wave come a bit, and then let's just see where that industry settles. And then there'll be plenty of winners, I'm sure, if Web3 does sort of take over, as we've seen with Web2. In terms of what I look for, team is obviously very important. You know, I think every angel investor will say that. I've turned down good opportunities of startups because I didn't think the team maybe were the right blend or had the right experience or maybe had what I think it takes to be a successful founder. A lot of that is my gut instinct. I'm sure I was wrong, but you've got to make a judgment call as an angel investor. I think that grit and determination is something I do look for. Passion of the topic, like why are you building this business? Like, you know, you'll see in the deck, like, why you? So why are you the best team to build it? But what's at your core that's making you found this business? Like, why are you so interested in it? Why are you going to spend the next 10 years trying to solve that problem? I think there has to be that sort of passion. And knowledge of the area is important because you're probably going to have to pivot along the way. And that's what our investors said to us at Design My Night. You know, we were a B2C platform, and they said, actually, our exit dinner was, we knew we weren't investing in Design My Night. We're investing in you guys knowing the bar and pub industry. And we knew you would land on something because you were so ingrained in that industry. You'd taken the time to understand the industry. We'd spoken to lots of bar owners. We weren't just sort of like a faceless B2C brand. So yeah, seeing that knowledge of the area that they're looking to start is super important to me. And the obvious one, which people, you know, do miss out on, is just the obvious problem you're solving. And, you know, it doesn't have to be this macro problem, but I do want to see a problem, you know, that, you know, everyone I'm sure would have heard the whole vitamin versus painkiller. You know, there are lots of nice to have ideas out there, which probably aren't for investing, but you could grow a very healthy business from it. But when I'm looking at that problem, I really want to understand the customer's pain. And I think if there is an obvious pain point, then that really excites me. And sometimes that is in a, you know, really niche part of a market. You know, for us, we were bars to start with. We just thought, let's nail the bar industry. Forget about restaurants, leave that to Open Table. So, you know, that very small glimpse of light as a niche within a bigger industry is also interesting to me. You know, you saw that with Twitch. It suddenly became this platform where you would watch gamers, you know, and I've listened to podcasts from their founders, and that's not how they intended it to start, but they just stumbled upon this very small, in the grand scheme of things, niche where people wanted, other gamers wanted to watch other gamers. So yeah, niches within sort of macro verticals excite me as well.
So, I mean, a few things to dig into there. I want to start with actually that last point around niches, right? So all too often I see decks where founders are trying to be all things to all people. I was trying to help out a founder who'd reached out to me a few weeks ago, and, you know, I'd gone through their deck and I just couldn't understand. He was trying to solve like 30 different problems. And I said, well, what are you actually doing? And I actually ended up coming up with his elevator pitch, because I was like, okay, all of this other stuff is gump. Like, it isn't stuff you're doing today. And even the stuff that you are doing is tangential to the actual problem you're solving, right? You say you're ed tech, you're not actually ed tech. You are effectively marketing enablement kind of business, right? So I think that whole point about finding a very, very narrow niche that you can solve and solve really well is really important. And that may be a niche within the market, right? It may be the demography or the, you know, the type of user. It may be a niche within the kind of product set. It may be a niche even geographically, right? So you may just solve, I don't know, the UK before you solve the US, for argument's sake, right? And I think one of the reasons I think that's really important is because when you are looking for investment, you want your investor to understand that you can tackle that problem, but there is potential, you know, potentially more to come, exactly as you said, right? Like, you guys tackled bars, and then that spread to kind of nightlife in general, right? Which I think is really compelling. The other thing I think, you know, that we've said just again, time and time again on this podcast is team and founder fit, you know, founder market fit, founder product fit is really, really important, right? Having that deep understanding of the problem that you're trying to solve. And I think that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to have come from that industry. It just means that you need to have understood that industry really well. And the way I think about it, again, I've seen a lot of edtech businesses over the last sort of 10 years. And often I found that the best solutions have actually been created by people who aren't within the education system, but still have a deep understanding of how it works, right? Because often when you're in the industry, you're blinkered, right, around what you see. And would you mind me asking, like, where does your deal flow come from? How can people sort of, you know, get in touch with if they have, you know, if they have a business that they'd like you to have a look at? And should they? I mean, like, the other question, I guess, which is sort of tied to that is, are you looking for those venture style exits at like 10, 20, 30, 40X? Or are you looking equally at, you know, more stable businesses that, you know, will just be great businesses over time?
So my deal flow, so we've got Horseplay Ventures, so that's horseplay.ventures, which is just Andrew and myself as angel investors. It's not a VC, we're not backed by LPs, it's just a brand around our angel investing, so people can send decks through there. I think the important thing to note as well for listeners who are raising are angels normally also have their own cycles. So, you know, as I say, we're in 54 now. We've started a new business, which we're investing heavily in personally as well. So we're sort of at a slowing down of our cycle unless we see something exceptional. And I'm also part of various syndicates where I can put smaller checks in. I can take it to the syndicate. But yeah, we feel like over the last sort of 4 years, you know, we've made our key bets now, and we want to see obviously where they settle. So that's not a fob off when angels or even VCs say that. You know, we do have our own cycles, unless you are incredibly wealthy and, you know, you've just got cash pouring out of your ears. What was the other question? I can't remember now.
So it was so how do founders find you, and also are you looking for those outsized exits, or are you also kind of investing in more stable businesses?
So we like to go in early, so like sub 5 million pre-money valuation. So you know, we're sort of pre-seed, I would say, even pre-seed. We've invested in Just Ideas and actually funded the founder bringing the product to market and building it. You know, that is the risky end of the market. I feel like us early stage angels don't get enough sort of credibility, and that you sort of just get stomped on when VCs come in. But actually it's us who are backing the founders when there's literally nothing, like pre-revenue, pre-product. You know, we've taken the gamble early on. The benefit of that is, as I said, you know, if you can get in sub five, we actually only need, you know, I say only, but, you know, if you can see them getting to like a 40, 50 million exit, and you can get a 10X, then as an angel, you're happy with that. So I think when we, you know, great, if one shoots off to the moon and is on its way to a unicorn, obviously not going to turn that down. But I think when we're looking at a business, our first thought is, can we see this exiting for 10X? So as I said, normally for us, that's, can that be, is that a 20 to 50 million pound business? And that's what we look at, you know, obviously versus VC that's looking for the, you know, the outlier that will pay back the whole fund. So a 50 million pound business doesn't interest a VC, but for angels, it's great. Like if you can get 10X back, you know, in say 5 years, that's a good return on your investment. So yeah, when we're looking at the business and the opportunity and the TAM and the financials, you know, I'm looking at that 5 year horizon on, you know, do I think these are the founders that can grow it to be like a 30 to 50 million pound business? And then when we get there, let's see what's next. And I think that's a much safer way to bet. Because, you know, when you're always looking for moonshots, well, as VCs will know, you miss 90% of the time.
Yeah, you.
Whereas if you're,
you'll talk yourself out of a lot of them, right?
Yeah, yeah. And you know, as I say, it just really depends on what returns you're looking for. You know, a 50 million exit to the outside world as an investor might be like, oh, they can't have made much. But if you're getting in at 1 or 2 million, then you've done very well out of that. So yeah, definitely more realistic. I see other angels that are the opposite and syndicates that are the opposite that are trying to find those hundred X ones, which is fine. But you know, interview me in 5 years and we'll see if I've made the right bets or not. But, you know, out of the 54 plus, we haven't had any close yet. So that's a good start.
Amazing. I think, I mean, there's a whole bunch more we could talk about. Like you talked actually a fair amount in various ways about portfolio construction, which even as an angel is really important, right? You talked about making sure you don't have an outweighed sort of number of ventures in your portfolio from the same verticals, equally like getting in at the right stage, at the right level, at the right sort of valuation to make sure that, yeah, if it does get to 20, 30, 40, 50 million, that you are making a sufficient return. I think, and what's really important there again is it doesn't even necessarily mean that the business has to exit at that stage, right? Because if the business is, as you say, successful to that extent, it may even carry on, but you may be able to take yourself out via a secondary round or something of that nature. So I think, and I 100% agree, I think certainly in the UK, Europe, the value that angels provide in getting a lot of ventures off the ground is immense. Unlike in the US, well, not unlike in the US, but whereas in the US, I think there's much more availability of venture at those very, very early stages, right? Where VCs in the US will back those ideas or those, you know, those back of the napkin kind of plans. But I just want to shift gears for a second, right? We've been really intentional about ensuring we elevate underrepresented voices on this podcast. And you have become and been, you know, increasingly vocal about the disparities that exist towards the LGBTQIA plus community. How can we move away from sort of rainbow washing? We're recording this during Pride Month in June 2022 in the UK. So how can we move away from that kind of rainbow washing and positive discrimination to promote better participation and access for people throughout the venture ecosystem and to be quite frank, beyond?
Yeah, I mean, it's a super tough question. I think we are moving in the right direction across all of the planes of underrepresented founders. I think as from a founder point of view to investors, I think the opportunity for a founder to be authentically themselves and not be judged for that is the most important. So I felt, you know, when I was running Design My Night, wrongly that people, especially like big customers who, you know, might be, you know, the sales director might be like an older white man. So I often hid my sexuality, not in the office, like my whole team, you know, knew what I was, but, you know, outwardly, I never really talked about it and sort of kept it to myself because I thought they might think of me differently. Would they think I'm not a good business person? Would they think I wasn't capable of running a business? And look, a lot of that is your own projection onto other people. You know, not once did I actually face that from anyone. You know, that was my own, obviously, internal demons that I was fighting as well. So I think VC is getting a lot better, you know, whether they're just being given a kick up the arse and, you know, now they're outwardly saying we're looking for this, this and this. They've got quotas, you know, for good or bad. I think you just need to not judge people based on, you know, based on appearance, based on their sexual preference, based on their gender identity. You can be an incredible founder wherever you are on the spectrum. You know, let's not forget female founders are still judged, you know, and that's, you know, we're talking male versus female as, you know, that's one out of two. So when you're talking about all the other gender identities and the sexual identities, we're still not there with just male and female founders. So I think there's a long way to go. You know, there's this huge misconception that, you know, the best founders are white, straight men. I think that is, they're the ones that have been funded over the last 30, 40 years. So actually a lot of the winners are straight white men because they're the ones that have had the opportunities. So I think, yeah, we need to see some more representation of all underrepresented founders at the top of corporates, and being successful founders exiting and then feeling comfortable enough to talk about their own, you know, where they are on any sort of spectrum, and then hopefully be that representation for younger people, but also for investors, to see that we're all as good as each other. You know, your gender or your sexual preference has nothing to do with what makes you a good founder or not.
Yeah, I mean, the way I've typically talked about it is you need to recycle throughout the ecosystem, right? So if you have more diverse LPs funding more diverse fund managers who then fund more diverse teams, who then also build more diverse teams. And again, I'm using diverse in its broader sense, exactly as you did. And having those teams then recycle through the system, that's going to just, you know, generate that top-down as well as bottom-up approach to it. And, you know, I think you're 100% right. Selection bias has obviously played a massive role in why those traditionally white, traditionally male, traditionally straight founders have been funded over time, but I don't have the exact metric to hand. But you know, it's been widely reported that actually, whilst female founders have been underfunded over the last, you know, how many years, you know, 10, 20, 50, take your pick, they actually outperform their white male straight peers. So, you know, the more diversity that you get, and it's a bit, again, it's a bit like portfolio construction, right? If you are only investing in consumer tech businesses, for argument's sake, and, you know, you're going through a massive period of inflation and price rises and cost of living crisis, then, you know, you can probably guess that a lot of those businesses are going to struggle. And if you're only invested in those businesses, you will struggle. It's exactly the same with diversity. You know, if you make sure that you bet across the spectrum, as you put it, then, you know, your chances of having successes across the spectrum also increase, right? So I think that's a really great way of looking at it. So look, finally, this pod is all about shooting your shot. That's why I called it Nothing Ventured. What would you say to those looking to get into entrepreneurship today, especially as we record this in June 2022, with all the doom and gloom and, you know, the VC winter I talked about, you know, all being highlighted in the media around hubris and startup land and the funding that goes with it, especially given that you've just launched Trumpet, and, you know, it'd be great to understand a little bit more about that as well.
Yeah, you know, whenever I speak to people either wanting to be founders, obviously you need to get the idea first, but or wanting to get into entrepreneurship, still, in the sort of, I've been in it since 2010. So, you know, in these last 12 plus years, this is still, you know, there's been no better time when you see the number of startups that are out there, especially in Europe now, and especially in the UK. You know, it really is a central hub for startups big and small. Yes, you know, you're probably seeing lots of people laid off from the sort of growth startups at the moment, but that shouldn't be a reflection of the whole scene. You know, that's a whole nother podcast on how they have decided to grow and where the sort of what is all hit the fan a bit. But also, If you know, there are so many great jobs in startups, small and big, you know, whether you're the fifth employee or the 15th or the 50th, I feel like going to work for a startup is the same as when I left university and you should go and work for a corporate. That's why I went to L'Oreal. You know, there were certain corporates that did great schemes for graduates. And it's not that we really have that in the startup world, but I feel like that is as good an opportunity now as working for a corporate is going to work for a startup. So, you know, I say, you know, take the leap. You can still get a very tidy salary in startups. You can obviously take equity if you're early on, which is a bit more of a gamble, but just go give it a go. I think if you want to be a founder but haven't got the idea yet, just go and work in startups, learn the lay of the land, see what you enjoy. That also might make you see whether you think you might need a co-founder, you know, when you actually see all the cogs needed to run a startup, like, do you have all of those necessary skills? So yeah, definitely just give it a go. And, you know, working in the ecosystem, I would say, first and foremost. You know, it's not easy to start a business financially and et cetera. You know, have some sort of privilege to be able to quit your job and, you know, maybe not have a salary for a year. So, you know, if that is the case, I say go and work in a startup and sort of learn the ropes. I think it's still a really good time. Look, VCs still have money they need to deploy. I think they're just being a bit more careful about it. They may be looking at different levers of growth, which is no bad thing. You know, maybe we're going through a period now of sustainable growth. How do we get to profitability? But that doesn't mean all VCs are just stopping funding. I think there will be a bit of a dry up because I imagine they'll be backing their own portfolio. or going to have to save some reserves to back their portfolio companies to get through this period more than they ever have. But you know, if you're starting a business now, I think it's a great lesson to grow a sustainable business. And if those are your metrics that you're starting with and you can show that off, then funding will come your way, whether it's angel or whether it's VC. And yeah, Trumpet is the new baby. In a nutshell, we looked at all the processes we were doing at Design My Night. You know, it's a great place to get ideas, is experience. And we thought of all the different sections within our business that could have done with a bit of renovation, let's say. And funnily enough, sales is, you know, I think salespeople are thought of like the estate agents of the startup world. And, you know, now actually more than ever, I think great salespeople are becoming like great developers. So I think actually it's going to be the time for really great salespeople. But we just looked at, you know, how we ran sales, and we just saw a big gap, which is crazy, that you've got, you know, on the one hand, all of your outreach tools and stuff like LinkedIn and Cognizant and all of that. And then the other, you've got your CRM, your HubSpot, your Salesforce. But in between that, the whole sales cycle, you've just got emails, you've got PDFs, you've got PowerPoints. And it just seemed like this big blocker of technology in that section in the middle of the sales funnel. So with Trumpet, we wanted to transform the sales cycle from cold outreach all the way to close. How we do that was using the idea of mini sites. So we wanted to sort of do away with the PDF deck to start with. You know, the PDF is 30-year-old technology. Anyone in sales will know, you know, the time it takes to get the template, upload your customer's logo, change the branding, change the colors, compress the file, put a video in it, and then send that in a big heavy email to a customer, which they probably won't open, is outdated. And then as a company, you've got like 800 decks in your Google Cloud all sat there. So we thought, okay, well, let's bring this into sort of the digital age, taking a lot of inspiration from Shopify and Canva. So we sort of wanted to turn salespeople into designers. So with Trumpet, they can, instead of a PDF deck, they can create a personalized mini site in minutes, make it look beautiful, very personalized to the customer, which is important on cold outreach. That gets your foot in the door because they open this link up and they're like, wow, this is incredible. And then the Trumpet link follows you on your deal cycle. So if it's live, so if you want to add more content, if you want to add pricing, you just add that to your mini site. You can chat back and forward with your customer within your Trumpet link as well. And then it becomes sort of like a collaborative deal room at the end. So you can upload all of your documentation, your contracts for signing, and everything's contained in this one link. So from a customer, you get one link from cold outreach, which follows you on your whole journey to the deal closing. So yeah, we sort of wanted to revolutionize that whole bit in the middle. We also wanted to create a bit of a B2C vibe with it. So again, in sales, you'll see a lot of the tools are like blue and white, talk about like sales enablement, all very boring. And you know, there's in all the other departments, you've got like Figma, Canva, Notion, Slack, you know, Trello. There's all these great tools, the MailChimp, that people feel an affinity to and they'll put the sticker on their laptop. But, you know, you don't see anyone with like a Salesforce sticker on their laptop. So with Trumpet, we wanted to create a real fun brand in the branding. It's not blue and white. The UX UI of the product is very intuitive and fun to use. We want our messaging to be very personal. We want to speak directly to salespeople, not in a fluffy way. And like, hopefully that, you know, Trumpet becomes that tool in the sales stack that when you have a business, you know, you get your CRM and you get your Trumpet, and that sort of sales, your sales stack down there. And then you get all the other tools I've just mentioned as well. And yeah, we've just opened up the beta. We've got 1600 sales teams now on the wait list, which is amazing, which we're super excited about. And yeah, we've just opened up the beta very slowly. We're sort of testing and iterating with our sort of first customers at the moment.
That's amazing. I think, again, a few things. You know, you talked about how the founders kind of get going and, you know, joining a startup, et cetera, is one of, you know, the best ways to learn. And equally, just as you guys did, right, with Trumpet, if you look at the problems that impact you, those are often the first problems that founders will solve, right? And that's always a great place to start, because if you are facing a pain point, the likelihood is that someone else is as well, right? And if it is a pain point that hasn't been widely exploited yet, then that's a great place to get started. It was funny, whilst you're talking about salespeople, like I think it was in Ben Horowitz's kind of Hard Thing About Hard Things where I first came across the term, but I think he talked about coin-operated monkeys, right? Like it's a very, very old school, you know, type of role. It is very people-led. It is, as you say, like completely non-techie, but could be made more technologically enabled without being dry, right? And you know, I think exactly as you said, you're selling to people now more than you're selling to companies, right? So at the end of the day, to turn it into more of a B2C kind of customer experience is a really slick way of obviously getting over some of that, you know, inertia and obviously, you know, PDF fatigue and all the rest of it. Nick, it's been absolutely amazing talking to you today. I'm so thankful you were able to join us. For our listeners, where's the best place for them to look for you online? Are you on LinkedIn, Twitter? How can they find you?
So yeah, LinkedIn is probably my best social. I'm very active and I try and share sort of real life from the coalface stories. You won't get any sort of BS quotes from me. So I like to be very real on LinkedIn. I'll engage with people as well. As you mentioned, I've got a podcast as well. So that's called Pitch Deck. So that's on all the platforms. I've had a few copycats. So if you search Pitch Deck, put my name in, like Pitch Deck Nick, and you'll see my one. And yeah, that's across all the platforms. Twitter is at Pitch Deck Pod. So that's mainly about the podcast rather than a personal account.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Nick. Really appreciate you being with me today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Ventured, an Emerge One production. Follow us on social and at nothingventured.tech to make sure you never miss another episode. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can support us by giving us 5 stars on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. We love to hear from our listeners to understand the topics and guests that they'd like to hear about and from most. Drop us a message via the links in the show notes, and thanks again for your support.